The Mike Lupica Podcast.
We are back now with the great Mike Lupica. He's one of the country's
most prominent
sports
columnists. Mike Lupica has covered just about every sport.
Candid interviews with legends he calls friends.
I was talking to Jordan about Woods after the basketball game the other night. Everybody in sports to be the next this guy, the next this guy. And Michael said, no, he's the first Tiger.
In your face questions.
How much of a dope is he?
Compelling.
A billion-dollar industry, the biggest we've ever had in sports in this country, often comes down to a flip of the coin.
This is the Mike Lupica Podcast. Here's Mike Lupica.
Hello and thanks for joining us on the Mike Lupica Podcast. Today we are thrilled, and I am thrilled, to be joined by one of my best friends in the world, the newest inductee, sounds great, of the Basketball Hall of Fame. He was a three-time All-NBA first-teamer, a five-time All-Star. He dominated as one of the league's best all-around point guards and could play the game above the rim. Won a title with the Celtics coming off the bench to help him in Game 7 in 74. Went on to coach in the NBA and in college. He is the great Paul Westfall. But before we get started with Paul, I want to let you know about Geico. Okay, everybody's got a to-do list. Drop off the dry cleaning, pick up some milk. But here's an idea. Let's save hundreds of dollars on car insurance. And the good thing is you don't have to drop off or pick up anything. All you have to do is go to geico.com. And in 15 minutes, you could be saving 15% or more on car insurance. Extra money in your pocket? It may just be the most rewarding to-do you do today. Welcome back to the Mike Lupica Podcast. I am so happy today to have my friend, it's frightening to say this, of 45 years, Paul Westfall, on with me again. He hadn't been on for about a year. It was recently announced over the weekend that he has been elected, finally, to the Basketball Hall of Fame. The induction ceremony, I think, is in September. He came off the bench in 1974 to help the Celtics win a championship in Game 7. He nearly beat the Celtics 2 years later with the Suns, and a series that included one of the greatest games I've ever seen, a triple overtime game in Game 5. Went on to coach in college, coached the Suns, gave Michael Jordan and the Suns, the Bulls, all they needed 1 year. Coached Charles Barkley, didn't get coached by John Wooden, and I can't tell you because I felt like I was in the wilderness for a while saying that you were unquestionably a Hall of Fame basketball player. But now, Paul, finally, it's official.
Well, I don't even it never had to happen, Mike. But the fact that it did, it takes some getting used to, and it just makes you think back on all the people along the way, and it's a pretty humbling, amazing thing, and it's fun to look back and talk about what happened to bring us where we are now.
Well, you know, Paul and I met when he was a rookie with the Boston Celtics, and I was a senior at Boston College, and I wrote a piece about him for Boston Magazine because it was a big thing there, no matter how good you'd been in college, that you were going to somehow sit mostly for the Boston Celtics. And we hit it off, and we started playing tennis at Boston College, and our friendship, my friendship with Paul and his wife Cindy, had evolved to the point where one summer he was going on an NBA trip to South America, and I was going to house sit for them. And he calls from the airport, and I said, "Paul, I'm very busy. I've got a party planned at your house tonight." And he said, "No, I just wanted to tell you I've been traded to Phoenix for Charlie Scott." And I said, "Paul, I thought I made it clear that I'm extremely busy here." He said, "No, I really got traded for Charlie Scott." And he left the Celtics and he went to the Suns. And we'll back up from there, Paul. But I really believe that your bona fides as a Hall of Famer began by helping put the Phoenix Suns on the map with that extremely memorable NBA Finals in 1976. And the triple overtime game is a part of NBA history now. And so I'm going to ask you something that I've asked you since we have been friends. Have you ever gone back and looked at it? Because for years you told me, no, it always ends the same way.
Well, I have looked at it, and it's funny when people come over to the house. Sometimes they'll want to see it, or they'll talk about how they saw it, and my wife will put it on, and it does always end the same way. But it, at the same time, even though it hurts every time I watch it, it's a privilege to have been a part of it at the same time, and it's a part of like you said, of NBA history and my personal history, and it was an amazing thing to be a part of. And it just the fact that it hurts 40 years later is probably good.
Paul, would it hurt as much if you hadn't already won an NBA championship? And the reason, you know, we've talked about this forever. We live in the gotta have a ring culture of modern professional sports. So I'm not saying it doesn't sting. You still wanted to win again in 1976 after winning in 74. But did the championship that you'd already helped win for the Celtics take at least some of the sting out of what happened 2 years later?
I never thought of it like that. I don't think so. I mean, Mike, I'm 68 years old. I've been in basketball until I retired a couple of years ago. My whole life, you know, at the highest level I could be at for whatever age I was at, you know. So say from like age 15, 14 or 15, they're like, I look back, they're like three teams that I was on or a part of that won the last game of the year and won the championship of whatever they could win. And probably there were at least 20 other times that I was with a team that could have won. You know, something happens and you don't win, but that, you know, that the team could have won. And every single time it hurts like crazy. And at the same time, that's what makes it so great when you do win. It's really hard to win that last game, whatever level it is. And, each one of them that never hurts any less. And when you do win, it's as good as it gets in sports.
And 2 years before, for people who don't know this or perhaps had forgotten it, Paul came off the bench and played 31 minutes in Game 7 against the Bucks in a game the Celtics won. So he had delivered in the highest moments. So now we fast forward to Game 5 at Old Boston Garden of the NBA Finals between the Suns. And the game ends up, obviously, as I've said, going triple overtime. But I've always said that you started becoming a coach that night, okay? Because there is a key moment, and I'll let you pick up the story, where there's 1 second left. And you're down a point.
First of all, Mike, there should have been over 2 seconds left. But we were in Boston, and I saw Red Auerbach fire a timer once for running the clock correctly and not letting it, you know, not stopping it in the Celtics' favor. So, I mean, you can, if anybody goes back and watches that game, you can see when Havlicek made that shot, there was over 2 seconds left. And they just let the clock run down. And I knew that trick because I'd been in Boston for 3 years. But so anyway, Havlicek made that shot. They let the clock run down, and people were swarming the court. They were going crazy because the Celtics were going to win by one, they thought. And our coach, you know, poor John McLeod, I mean, he was holding off drunks, running, you know, just swarming past him with no security.
Richie
at all.
Powers had already gotten attacked by a fan earlier that night. I know. It was a crazy circus-like atmosphere that night. I was there, so I could speak.
Yeah, it was mayhem. But anyway, I knew that they should put time back on the clock, and I also knew that if we took the ball underneath the basket with 1 or 2 seconds left, we could never get a good pass up the floor and get a shot.
Right.
It was just something that I had learned. I picked up as a little kid in L.A. watching USC football or listening to it on the radio with John McKay when they were behind at the end of the game and they were trying to drive up the field for an important score. They were out of timeouts. They couldn't stop the clock legally, but they could call illegal timeouts. And in football, it was a 5-yard penalty, but you got the timeout. And so you could keep the drive going. And so I learned that principle, and I just, in that situation, applied it to basketball. I said, well, the penalty doesn't fit the crime, so if we call a timeout, even though we don't have one, they'll grant it. The penalty's a technical foul. So if we lose by 2 points instead of one, we still lose. But we will have a chance because we'll get to move the ball to half court and inbound the ball and maybe make a miracle shot to either win it or tie it, depending on if they make the free throw. So I called the timeout. The official said, you don't have a timeout. And I said, I know, but we call it. And he said, okay, as long as you know what you're doing. And then that's what happened. And Garfield Hurd made that shot and prolonged that game.
And through the fog of memory, we're talking to Paul Westphal, just announced over the weekend, has made the Basketball Hall of Fame. But through the fog of memory, when did our dear friend Paul Silas call a timeout for the Celtics that they didn't have? Was that later, right?
No, that was the end of regulation. We missed a shot with about one or two seconds left. And Paul got the rebound, and he turned to Richie Powers with the ball under his arm and made the tee and said, timeout. And Richie was looking right at him.
I know he was.
And he just let the clock run down, and it went into overtime. And that was – so there were two illegal timeouts in that game. Only one of them were called.
Hey, Paul and Al Bianchi, a lifer in the NBA, was an assistant coach with the Celtics, and he later on he had a championship ring, a fake championship ring made up that, and inside I think the inscription read Richie some blanking Powers, did it not?
Absolutely, very true. Al would show that to anybody who wanted to see it, and it was. Very heartfelt.
And so it's the game ends up 128-126. Other than that night, did you ever make a 360 shot before? Because you made one down the stretch that night.
Mike, I hate to say this, but it probably comes off wrong. I make those shots all the time. but they had me handcuffed so bad in the NBA that I tried to only take good shots.
Right, right.
And like in playgrounds and pickup games, I mean, I love that. I'd take stuff like that all the time. But I really tried to tone it down because of percentages and good shot selection and coaches getting mad at me and stuff like that. But I had a lot of hot dog in me that I kept covered up in order to not come off as a gunner. But I don't know if that worked or not, but... No, that shot, I could make that shot. In fact, I made that shot when I was like 50 coaching at Pepperdine. Some of the players saw that thing and said, oh, you were lucky. And I said, oh, yeah, and I can still do it. It was just a little trick shot.
My dear friend Earl Monroe, and said this in a completely respectful way, said to me one time about Westphal, he said, well, your boy's white and from Southern California, but he sure does play black. And I took that as one of the nicest things anybody ever said about your game.
Well, Mike, you know, they asked me, I don't know if anybody saw it, but when they had that little show when they revealed the Hall of Fame, they said, uh-huh. You know, what was your greatest honor? And I said, this is it, I'm sure. But until this, the greatest honor I ever had, I said, I hope I'm not being politically incorrect, but I'm 68, so you have to let me, is that when I would walk through an airport, and this is like 15, 20 years after I retired, there was never, ever, and there's never a sky cap that didn't recognize me.
Yep.
And they would say, that was a bad white boy. And I took it as the greatest compliment because, you know, there was a time in this country when blacks couldn't play in the NBA. They wouldn't let them play.
Yep.
And then after they were, you know, allowed to play, they dominated the sport. And it became that if you're a white guy, you're probably just some token, you know, that's how much the black player dominated the league. And to be recognized as somebody that wasn't a token that could play with the best by people that would have every reason to be bitter if they wanted to, there was no greater honor at all. And if I'd never made the Hall of Fame, that would have been plenty. And so, you know, to hear somebody like Earl Monroe say that, it's it's really cool. I mean, I always emulated, like I grew up in L.A., I emulated Elgin Baylor, and people said, well, he's, you know, I had a nickname Jerry West Jr. growing up in L.A., because I look more like Jerry West, but the guy I tried to play like was Elgin Baylor. Right. And to be appreciated for that meant a lot more to me than anything else that ever happened as far as getting an honor in the NBA.
Hall of Famer, and man, that has a nice ring to it. Paul Westfall is our guest on the Mike Lubega podcast. Much more with Paul right after this from our friends at Kronos. No one compliments you when their paycheck is correct, but make one mistake and you risk alienating your entire workforce. With Kronos, we make sure your payroll is done right the first time, from punch to paycheck. Embedded checklists, simplified workflows, a single source of truth. HR, payroll, talent and time, keeping in one unified system. All with a proven implementation approach and simplified, transparent pricing. Learn more about Kronos.com/payroll. Kronos, workforce innovation that actually works. Paul comes out of Redondo Beach, California. He's the greatest player in the history of a high school that's not even a high school anymore, which is one of my favorite names considering the way he played, Aviation High School, and was extremely highly recruited. And John Wooden wanted Paul to go to UCLA. And you finally elected to go cross town instead because you wanted to be on a team that knocked off UCLA, despite all the respect you had for Coach Wooden.
That's absolutely true. And there was a lot of controversy, and people thought, oh, SC, he must have gone there because he got paid. I didn't get paid. I didn't want to get paid anywhere and didn't get paid. But, you know, there were a lot of reasons. I was on the fence about whether to go to SC or UCLA right up until the night before the letter of intent was to be signed. And John Wooden's great assistant coach, Jerry Norman, was supposed to come by the house that night and take me out to dinner the night before the decision. And when he got to the house, I said, Coach, I can't go to dinner with you. I've decided to go to SC. And he said, well, go out anyway. Let's, you know, he's going to still try to talk me into it. I said, no, Coach Wooden. Yeah. Coach Wooden once told me that once you make up your mind, don't look back, because, you know, people go to one school and they don't think they're playing enough, and then they transfer, and, you know, it's once you make up your mind, you have to dig in and make it work. You know, don't look back. Keep your word and make it work. And I said, Coach Wooden told me that. You don't want me to go against Coach Wooden, do you? And so he couldn't argue with that. But, you know, for years people would say, why'd you go to USC, a football school, instead of UCLA, where you could play for Coach Wooden? And there were a lot of simple answers I gave. Like I said, well, you know, UCLA, you know, takes you 4 years to get your degree in 1 year. It takes you 5 years, though, because it takes 1 year to find a place to park. And I stole that line from John Stewart of the Kingston Trio, but I liked it. And so I would say that. And for years, I mean, I stayed in touch and actually close with Coach Wooden.
Yeah, I know.
Even though I didn't go there.
I know.
And finally, he was in his 90s, and I was coaching at Pepperdine, and he came out to the house. Or not to the house, he came out to Pepperdine to talk to our team. He's like 92, and he watches practice, and he's signing books and signing autographs, and he talks to the team for like an hour and a half after practice, and it was just an amazing thing. And so I was driving him back to his place in Encino. It's about an hour from the Pepperdine campus, and we're talking. And he goes, Paul, he goes, I really want to know, what's the real reason you didn't go to UCLA?
Not that he'd had a hard time letting go.
and I said, Coach, you didn't really need me, did you? He goes, and he laughed. And, you know, but he goes, really, what's the real reason? I know there's more to it. And I said, well, you know, Coach, there were actually a couple players there that I knew. It just wouldn't have worked. It wouldn't have worked being on the same team with them. And I'm not going to name them right now, but he knew, you know, I named them to him, and he knew what I was talking about. And he says, I can understand that. Coach,
one addendum to this story is at SC, you went 24-2 one year, didn't you?
Yeah, my junior year, we were 24-2. Part of the year, we were number one in the nation. The rest of it, we were number two. We kept trading number one and number two with UCLA. But they beat us twice, and we were number two in the country, and we were number two in L.A. And yep. We couldn't go anywhere because if you didn't win your conference, you weren't going to the NCAA tournament, and that was it.
What year did you have your knee injury? Because it obviously it did affect your draft status coming out of college. And I tell this story all the time. I used to go to see Red Auerbach's camp in the summer. And the rookies would show up and there'd be these awesome pickup games. And the first thing I ever saw you do with my own eyes on a basketball court, on an outdoor court at Red's camp, was you drove down the lane and it was your left knee you'd hurt, right?
It was my left knee. Yeah, I hurt it my senior year. It ended my season, before halfway through my senior year.
And so they're playing a pickup game, and Westfall goes, he's completely ambidextrous. He goes down the lane in traffic, goes off on his right leg, and throws down this thunderous dunk. And I turned to our friend Bob Ryan. I said, okay, so the knees aren't really going to be an issue with the Celtics. But then you end up, for a while, on the place where all rookies, no matter how celebrated, ended up with the Boston Celtics at the end of the bench.
Absolutely. And, you know, looking back on it, and even at the time, I mean, JoJo White, future Hall of Famer in his prime, John Havlicek, future Hall of Famer in his prime, and Don Chaney, the best defensive guard of his era, those guys were going to play. And I was going to, like Red would say, I could sit and learn from those guys. Yeah. And it was frustrating, but I did understand, but I didn't like it. And it was the best thing that could have happened to me, though. It to learn from those guys, Don Nelson, Satch Sanders, Paul Silas, Dave Cowens.
Amazing amount of coaches came off that team. I talk about that all the time. It's that group produced several NBA head coaches.
Yeah, incredible. And it was the best way to learn what the NBA was all about. And, it's frustrating, but I wouldn't have it any other way looking back.
Talking to Paul Westfall on the Mike Lupica podcast. And then, Paul, again, it wasn't just you, and obviously everything came together that year, that first year in Phoenix. You and Alvin Adams became a part of Suns lore and legend forever, but that team and that moment put professional basketball in Phoenix on the map in a way that it had never been before. And, you know, again, I was lucky enough to be around that final, and it was just an extraordinary experience, but with everything you had done, everything was just preamble in Boston. That's when you started playing yourself to Springfield in the Basketball Hall of Fame.
Well, that time, that team was so special. I mean, when you think about even the history of Arizona, I mean, there was such an inferiority complex, this little outpost in the desert. You know, yeah. It was amazing that they had a basketball team and then that they were – you know, they were so used to always just getting their brains beat out by the Lakers. And you know, nobody really thought, I don't think that Phoenix could support a pro basketball franchise or any pro sports team for long. But then the next thing you know, we keep knocking off teams and we're in the finals against the great Boston Celtics. And the place, it just couldn't have been more electric. And it was like Phoenix's coming out party. I think the people that were alive and in Phoenix at that time, everybody remembers that season.
The madhouse on McDowell Street.
Yeah, the madhouse on McDowell. And that team, if you remember, that team had a lot of future NBA coaches on it, too. It had Pat Riley, John Wetzel, myself, Garfield Hurd. Trying to think. There were a couple others. Dick Van Arsdale coached. It was a very, very smart team. And John McLeod was the perfect coach for us. And that team captured the imagination. The great, late, great Joe Gilmartin wrote that book, The Little Team That Could and Almost Did, about the season. But it was that team, in a lot of ways, was a lot like the Celtics in that you know, we had Keith Erickson on that team. We had guys that were there to win.
Yep.
And wanted to play together and loved the battle, you know, just never gave up. And the Celtics were like that. That team was like that. And it was as good as it gets in basketball.
Paul, you know, it's funny. Often, even great players in professional sports are part of one celebrated trade. You were a part of two. And I think when you got traded to Seattle in 1980 for Dennis Johnson, I think it was on the cover of Sports Illustrated. And at the time, because of your status in the game and Dennis's, it was one of the biggest deals in NBA history.
Well, yeah, we were both all-star guards in our prime. I thought I was in my prime. It turned out that was the end of my prime. But yeah, it was straight up all-star for all-star. And I guess it happened in baseball. What was it, Harvey Keene for Rocky Colavito or something like that?
Yep, that's right. It did.
So I got traded twice, and each time it was for a Hall of Famer. So it's pretty cool to look at the trivia of that.
And then at one point, again, the fog of memory, where were we? Were you holding out? What was going on in Seattle that I was the only deal I ever negotiated in my newspaper career got you to the New York Knicks?
It's a long story. How much? I'll try to give the shortest version of it.
I was a good agent. You got to admit, I turned out to be a terrific agent. I got you to New York.
You got me to New York. This was so interesting to me because I was right in the middle of it. But when I got traded to Seattle, I had 1 year left on my contract. And my Howard Slusher, the greatest agent of all time,
great,
was my agent. And he also represented Gus Williams of the Sonics. And the big thing was that we were going to be the backcourt up there. Gus was already there, and they'd had great success. And that was like Howard's dream to have us play together. So anyway, when I got traded, he says, you need to hold out. And I said, no way. I got a year left of my contract. He goes, he says, this is the time, you should have them extended. And I go, no, I'm not going to do that. Which was the dumbest thing I ever said. But because after nine games, anyway, Gus was holding out. Gus's contract was up, and he was holding out. And if you remember, he held out the whole season. He's one of the first guys that didn't play the whole year holding out.
Yep, I do remember, yeah.
So I got up to Seattle, and after nine games, I go, my foot starts hurting. And it was a stress fracture, which nobody knew how to diagnose stress fractures in those days. So I tried to play with this broken foot, and I wasn't that good. And, it's like, I can play because those things don't show up on x-rays till the healing begins, which is a weird thing. But so the whole year, I'm in and out of the lineup with a sore foot, and the owner thought I was faking. He thought I was faking in order to put pressure on him to sign Gus Williams.
Right.
So he was going to stick it to Howard Slusher and not give me a contract when the year ended. So the whole next summer, after it was an abominable year because of my broken foot, my contract was up, but they had what was known as the right of first refusal,
yep,
which meant that no team could sign me. They would have the right to match any deal I had. So even though my foot was healed, he was gonna get back at Slusher, because in the meantime he had signed Gus to like a multi-year contract. The holdout was a success for Gus. In fact, he gave Gus a Rolls Royce signing bonus. But for me, he was gonna stick it to Slusher because he thought he had the leverage.
Right.
And so I had to hold out the next year, even though I wanted to sign. I wanted to play with Gus, but Schulman wouldn't sign me, but he wouldn't let me go either. So I was in NBA limbo, where I was healthy, but I couldn't play, and half the season went by. And at one point, this is a sideline, this is a great story, if you're following, Donald Sterling owned the San Diego Clippers, and how they were terrible. And Howard talked to him halfway through the season that I'd been forced to sit out for half the year, and worked out a deal that Shulman could not match. He based it on wins because Seattle had a pretty good team then. So the Clippers had very few wins. So he had a contract loaded with incentives based on if we won so many games, which the Clippers could never win, I'd get paid an exorbitant amount of money. But if the Sonics matched it, they would end up paying me an exorbitant amount of money because they were going to win those games. And so Slusher had a deal all set to go with Donald Sterling, and they didn't sign it. And so we found out later, Slusher asked him, he said, how come you didn't sign Westfall when you had that chance? Because it was cheap, and you could have got him. You could have got an all-star guard. And he said, well, he might have helped us win.
There you go.
And he wanted to leave San Diego, and the only way he could get to leave to San Diego to go to L.A. was to have a horrible team. So he drove the team into the ground, and he wouldn't sign players because he didn't want to win in San Diego because he wanted to go to L.A. And so that deal fell through, and then you came along, and Howard offered the Knicks, who were having a terrible year in Red Holtzman's last season there, he offered them the same deal, and they took it. And so you wrote that article, and the Knicks signed me for the last 20 games of Red Holtzman's last season. And that was a great time playing for Red Holtzman. God. And then that's how I got to New York. And thanks, Donald Sterling.
Yeah, and no, Jack Crumpy was running the garden. Yeah, I finally called him up, and I said, what are you doing? This guy's sitting out there. Go look at his resume. They brought you in, and you got the experience of playing for Red Holtzman, and you know how much we both love Red Holtzman. And then the next year, you accomplished something that I don't think has ever been duplicated in the National Basketball Association. Hubie Brown put you at point guard. You became the comeback player of the year in the league, and then got cut.
That was awesome too, Mike. That's another long story, but did you know that the reason I got cut is because of Kevin McHale?
No. No, that I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. So when I signed with the Knicks, Howard and I negotiated a deal with the Knicks that they would not hold the right of first refusal for me because the right of first refusal had killed me in Seattle.
Right.
So I had the only deal in the league that didn't give the team that owned my rights the right of first refusal. Right. I thought that was brilliant. But what happened is after that season with Hubie's first season with the Knicks, they decided to go after Kevin McHale, who was a free
agent. By the way, you make the playoffs. You made the playoffs that year.
We gave the Fofo and Fo Moses Malone team the best series they had. They had one of the best teams of all time, and we cooked them down to the wire every game.
Yep,
and we had arguably a second or third best team in the league that year with the Knicks. After the smoke cleared, the first half was horrible, and the second half we finished great. Bernard King and those guys, it was a great team. But anyway, so the Knicks decide to make a run at McHale. They give him a big offer, and Red Auerbach got mad, and he said, "You're not messing around with any kids here." So he. He matched the deal for McHale, and then he went after every Knicks free agent and offered them double or triple what they were worth in order to make the Knicks match and send a message to them, you don't mess around with Red Auerbach and the Boston Celtics. And so he was going to drive the Knicks payroll through the roof. And so the Knicks had like six free agents, Sly Williams and Edmund Sherrod and a few guys. He gave them all these exorbitant contracts, but he didn't offer me a contract because the Knicks didn't have the right of first refusal. So the Knicks had to cut me in order to sign all the free agents because Red drove up the price because he was mad about Kevin McHale. So that's why the comeback player of the year got cut.
It might be my favorite part of your resume. We are talking to Paul Westfall, now an official member of the Basketball Hall of Fame. He'll be inducted in September. Okay, so then you finish out your career with the Suns. You accidentally go into coaching. You coach a small Bible college in Phoenix. Then you go to Grand Canyon. And it's just funny how that worked out, Paul, because you win. It was the NAIA championship, right, at Grand Canyon?
Right.
But they had it on ESPN. Yep. And Paul's coaching Grand Canyon, but Vital is there. And he doesn't know any of these players, but he knows who Paul is. And so by the end of that tournament, you know, you're not watching on television. I am. Okay. He made you sound like you were Red Auerbach. Okay. and he instantly grew your profile as a coach. You end up sitting next to Cotton Fitzsimmons in Phoenix. When Cotton retires, you become the head coach. And fast forward, you won 60 games twice, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, Paul ends up on in the finals against Michael and the Bulls in 1993. And what is fascinating about this, and it's funny how sports sometimes doesn't give you all the payback you want, but sometimes it does, okay? Paul Westfall ends up coaching a triple overtime game in the NBA Finals 17 years after Game 5 against the Celtics, except this time, your team won the game.
Right. It was a lot of people remember that series, too.
In Chicago, by the way. In Chicago Stadium, by the way.
It was wild. It was so great being in Chicago. It used to be the 2-3-2 format. And so we lost the first two games in Phoenix, and everybody was burying us. And we won Game 3. Lost Game 4, and then we had.
Well, tell the Save the City. Tell the Save the City story. That's my favorite coaching story.
Yeah. So Game 5, we're on the brink of elimination, and as we're driving to the game in our bus, we have the police escort through the city and everything to get to the game. All the stores on Michigan Avenue, they're all boarded up. Yeah. Because what are they boarding up these stores for? Oh, they're getting ready for the celebration, and people riot, and they, you know, they break windows and they burn cars and everything. And it's going to be the biggest celebration in the history of Chicago. It's going to be mayhem. And so I didn't even do a pregame talk. I didn't do any scouting report. Who we knew these guys? I just wrote on the board, "Save the city." We didn't want Chicago to get destroyed because we like Chicago. And the mayor didn't appreciate that. Mayor Daley, we won the game and it came out about the Save the City, and he was all offended and everything. I thought we did a civic service by beating the Bulls that day.
You absolutely did. All right. So you are coaching at that point in your life. The basketball gods present you Charles Barkley. And what was it like to coach Charles?
It was... There's two things you have to understand about Charles, and he's the same today as he was then. He's an unbelievable competitor, and if he gets bored, you know, he's just he can't focus, and he's a clown. So he's a competitor and he's a clown at the same time, and he's got so much more. He's got a big heart and everything else, but you just had to understand that about him. He was gonna drift away a few times a year and to just be silly.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he was there when you needed him at the biggest time. There's one story. There's a few stories about Charles that kind of help sum him up. But basketball wise, we were playing Utah with the great John Stockton and Karl Malone, the greatest pick and roll combination in the history of basketball, and they were magnificent. And Charles, next to Shaq, was the worst pick and roll defender in the history of the NBA. Yeah. And so, you know, we're getting ready to play the Jazz, and in the shoot around. You know, one of the things you do in the NBA is you decide how you're going to defend these very situations. And so we're talking about how we're going to defend the Stockton-Malone pick and roll that night. And there's like four or five different different schemes you can use. And so before I decide that none of them's going to work unless Charles buys in. So I said, Charles, how do you want to play the pick and roll? What do you see? How do you think we can play this? And so, we decide we're going to do it Charles way. And so that's how we're going to play the pick and roll that night. So what we're going to do is we're going to force Stockton to drive baseline, and Charles will be waiting for him down there. We rotate them on anyway. So we're going to push it down, they call it. So the first time they come down and run the pick and roll, Kevin Johnson does what he's supposed to do. He pushes, he directs Stockton toward the baseline where he's supposed to go. Well, Charles isn't there. He's up guarding Malone tight on the shoulder, so Stockton just dribbles in and makes a layup. Charles completely blew the coverage after he's the one said how we're going to play it. So I call timeout. I go, Charles, what are you doing? He goes, oh, yeah, my bad. I don't want to play it that way. Let's force him over the screen, and I'll show and get back to Malone. Okay. So the next time down, they run the pick and roll, of course, and KJ does what he's supposed to do, and Charles is down at the baseline where he was supposed to be the last time. So Stockton comes off wide open for an elbow jumper, sinks it, because Charles wasn't where he's supposed to be. I call timeout. I go, Charles, now you're over. What's going on? He goes, well, I don't like any of this stuff. He says, this is what I really want to do. He says, let him use the screen, and when he comes off, I'll clothesline him. Yeah. They won't run it anymore. And I go, Charles, I go, I think you're kidding, but you'll get suspended. You don't want to hurt Stockton. He goes, no, let's clothesline.
We're talking to Paul Westfall on the Mike Lubega podcast. Now, I have to ask you a question. I don't want to relitigate the past, but I happen to have your NBA coaching record in front of me, okay? Your first 3 years as the head coach of the Phoenix Suns, you're 62-20, 56-26, 59-23. And the first bump in the road you hit the next year, you got fired. How did that, what? I can't even remember what the heck precipitated after your record for 3 years was 177-69. And you start off, it's not like you started off 0-33. You're 14-19 and you got fired.
Well, we had four starters injured too. Don't forget that. They were out for all that time.
Yeah.
Charles, Danny Manning, and
but wasn't DJ Jerry Marlo. Colangelo really more mad at Charles than you, and he fired you?
Well, that you'd have to ask Jerry about that. I mean, it really hurt at the time, Mike. But I look back on it, and we lost to the best team in a great series with, Michael Jordan beat us. And then the next year, we lost to the team that won the championship in seven games, the best series they had. It was Olajuwon and that Houston team.
Yep.
And then the next year, we lost to the best team in a seven-game series, who the team that won the championship. It was Olajuwon again. But we had a lead. We had a lead in both of those series. And Houston came back and beat us. And looking back, they had an unbelievable team. And Olajuwon was the best player on the floor and in the league, including Charles, those 2 years. But we lost. And I think Jerry felt that we should have found a way to win one of those. And so I think that the clock was probably ticking for me when Olajuwon, when we lost that second time to Olajuwon. And so when we didn't get off to the start, I think Jerry just felt it was that maybe somebody else could get it done. And that's my magnanimous self talking. And I didn't always feel
that's your high road Hall of Fame self talking. That's what that is right there.
And well, I've got a lot more experience now too, and I it's not personal in the league when you get fired. I mean, there are reasons, and I think Jerry just felt that somebody else should have a crack at it if Charles had any prime left, and he really didn't at that time. He was pretty much a shell of he wasn't Charles Barkley anymore. He was just a good player at that time, and if Charles Barkley's on your team, you need him to be Charles Barkley, or you're gonna have trouble.
Talking to Paul Westfall, who, full disclosure, has been one of my closest friends of my adult life. Okay, here's my favorite Charles story about your time together in Phoenix. Early the season, I think I told you this, maybe I didn't. Early the season, when you do get fired, My wife, Taylor, are out visiting Paul and Cindy. We'd go out once a year, usually, to Arizona, because it was an excuse to get to Arizona and see them. And so, you know, we're sitting in the front row, and your team is in the layup line. And Charles sees me, and he gets out of the layup line, and he comes over, and he said, "I know you're hearing these rumors. Don't worry. I got this. I'll take care of Paul." Okay?
Yeah.
You got fired 2 weeks later. I got this. I said, "Oh," I turned to Taylor. I said, "No worries. Charles has got this." And I believe it was like 12 days later he got fired.
I guess he didn't have as much juice as he thought he did. But it was great. It was a fantastic time. I mean, I don't really have anything but fantastic memories coaching that team. It was an amazing group of guys. I mean, a lot of it was one of the most fun teams ever, with Marley and KJ and Charles and you know, Richard Dumas, Oliver Miller. I mean, fantastic talents. It was Danny Manning. It was quite a group that Jerry put together.
We're talking with old number 44, recent inductee into the Basketball Hall of Fame, Paul Westfall, on the Mike Lubica podcast. More with Mr. Westfall in a minute, but first this from Geico. Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Go to geico.com and 15 minutes. That's all it takes. And in 15 minutes, you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Paul, when you look back, and this, you know, this is the kind of occasion, you gave a wonderful interview the other day at the ceremonies. And when you look back, and you've told stories about John Wooden, but I also know how much you love the old man in Boston, because, you know, I love the old man in Boston. And to know Red Auerbach, you know, I used to come down sometimes at the house, and I'd be smiling, and Taylor said, "What?" And I said, "Sometimes I feel like I have the best job in the world, because I just spent a half hour on the phone with Red Auerbach." Okay. And, you know, Paul knows this story. Red, at the end of his life, was walking with a cane, and my dad needed one, but was reluctant to get one. Okay. And I'm telling the story to Red one day, and he says, "Give me your father's phone number." And I give him Ben Lupica's phone number. And I know that my dad is sitting, we're having coffee in Boston, and I know my dad's sitting having coffee with my mom up in Nashua, New Hampshire. And the phone rings, and my dad picks up the phone, and it's Red. And Red says the following to my sainted father: "Don't be a schmuck, get a cane," and hung up. Okay. And my dad went out and bought one that day. And I told Paul, I said, "Red was still coaching up people even when he was 85 years old."
Well, that's just the perfect Red story. I mean, he's a lot like Charles. He had a big heart, and he didn't really want people to think that. But when you told me the story before, and your dad said, "Who is this?" And Red says, "You know who it is." And they'd never spoken before, and he was right. To me, that's the best part of the story. Red knew that your dad would know who he was.
He knew who he was because Red used to, once a year, Red would he wouldn't sit with him, but he'd give my dad his seats. Those famous seats halfway up at the Garden, and Dad would take his buddy, and they'd go sit there, but they'd never actually been in each other's presence. Yeah, you know who this is. Yeah.
No, there's never been a better NBA coach or executive than Red. And just anybody that hasn't read a book about him, you got to do it. I mean, what a character. You can't make it up. What a bigger-than-life person Red was. And every player that ever played for the Celtics, you know, like, I was there 3 years. I heard all his stories three times. I mean, poor Havlicek. He probably heard him 17, 18 times, however many years he played. But it was just so special to be around the Celtics. And, you know, teams that played against him hate him, and I understand that, lighting the cigars and everything. But he made the NBA, and there'll never be another one like him.
Paul, you know, I've told you this story, and I wrote it one time in Esquire when it was the 50th anniversary. Everybody's doing these blue ribbon panels and these committees to the all-time this and the all-time that. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, I don't need a blue ribbon commission. The old man was there the day the league opened and he was still around. And I said, I'll just call him. So he gave me his 12 players. Okay. And I'd have to go back and look up. You could probably figure out most of them are. And then I finally said to him, okay, all the best players of all time are in the gym. You have first pick. Are you taking Michael or are you taking Russell? And he thought about it for a minute and he said, Michael. I said, wait a minute. I said, you and Russell changed basketball history. You know, the Celtics won 11 championships in 13 years. And he paused and he said, but I got to sell tickets too. And then he paused again, Paul. And he said, this, I will remember this to my dying day. He said, you got to be realistic. And I'm thinking to myself, that's how modern he was. Okay. Yep. That's that he put his, he took his coaching hat off and he put his businessman's hat on. He said, he's probably thinking, I might not win quite as much with Michael, but I'm going to sell a hell of a lot more tickets.
Red is always one step ahead.
I told Paul one time when I was first coaching my children in basketball, I called Westfall and I said, give me my coaching plan. And he said, here's your whole coaching plan. I said, and I got like, I got a pen. We're talking on the phone. I got a notebook. I'm ready to go. He said, if you're open, shoot. If your teammate's open, pass it to him and let him shoot and have fun. And every team I ever coached, I tell him that was my coaching plan. And I tell that to Auerbach one day. He says, add one thing. And I said, what? He says, if you miss a few, keep shooting. Paul,
perfect.
Do you miss the league? You know, I look at your career, your playing career. You coached in three places. You were an assistant in Dallas. You were an assistant in Brooklyn. You got to sit next to Cotton Fitzsimmons. We could do another whole podcast on him. But yep. I have a feeling that you left it all out on the floor. That there's nothing for you to miss now about professional basketball, even though you remain a fan.
Well, I wouldn't mind being, if I had a job where I was in the front office and made some decisions and tried to direct things to the way.
Do I have to call the Suns again? Do I have to agent you again? Huh?
No, that's okay. That's not happening, I don't think. But, you know, I'm perfectly, completely satisfied and love my life. And at the same time, I think once you have basketball, it's hard to get it out of you. But I don't know about you, but there's a lot about this game that these days I wish would change. I mean, what's the big idea of seeing how many threes you can shoot and, you know, not being able to touch somebody on defense? I think that what the game has become, that one of the big beauties of the game used to be, like, you could look at Utah. They had an offense and an identity, and you had to prepare because they really had a way they played that was different than other teams. And the same thing for wherever Phil Jackson was at the triangle, and Don Nelson had a system, and Hubie Brown had a system, and every place you went, there were a lot of nuances and a lot of differences that made the game interesting. And now every single team runs the same offense, and they run the high pick and roll, spread guys to the corner, and see how many threes or dunks you can get. And I really think the game has lost a lot of the nuance and interest that it should have, that the game deserves to have. So I'm a little down on all the threes right now, even though the college game last night, wasn't that amazing? I loved the Final Four and the whole thing this year. It was beautiful basketball.
And you know what else, Paul?
High drama.
My friend Frank Isola said this on Twitter last night, and I completely agree. Wasn't it nice to see another gets Chris Beard, who did an unbelievable job with Texas Tech, and he's not a screamer either. Wasn't it nice to see the way Tony Bennett behaved on the sideline through all of these life and death games? Apparently, you don't have to scream at kids to get them to play good.
It was fantastic. I mean, what a that whole game, both teams, you know, it's as classy as it gets. And it was really fun. It was one of the great examples of what basketball can be, watching those teams go at it and watching how everybody acted afterward. It was really special.
It was such a good game. And, Paul, my expectation, I really did think it was going to be like 49-47, and a wonderful basketball game broke out where they were still playing defense, but sometimes as good as you are on defense, offense can still win the day. And I mean, I love the kids on Texas Tech. I love Jerome. I love that kid, Guy, Hunter. It was such a satisfying game, and that to me was the beauty of this time of year in basketball. Listen, man, you know how happy I am that you're in the Hall of Fame. You know, I got stuck a long time ago. I also thought you were a top 50 player. Your game was unique to you, and you have honored this sport from the time you left aviation high school. So my love to your bride, and congratulations all over again.
Well, Mike, everybody should have a friend like you, and it just thank you. Love you.
And it's so well deserved, and it will be a great occasion for the extended Westfall family, of which I consider myself a part, in September. Well done, my friend, and everybody. You know, this, I'm lucky enough to know people like Paul Westfall. These are the kinds of conversations we're now having twice a week instead of once a week. So continue to download, continue to subscribe, and we'll talk to you on Thursday, everybody.
The Mike Lupica Podcast is produced and distributed by Compass Media Networks in conjunction with Hiltzik Creative. For iPhone users, go to the podcast app and search the Mike Lupica Podcast. Click on the Mike Lupica Podcast icon and subscribe. For non-iPhone users, you can listen on Google Play Music, TuneIn, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast platform.